appreciate your being here. As I've said each time, this is a class, and I want class participation. And I also want alertness, because this is heavy material, and I want you to stay with me. So appreciate your willingness to try to do that to the best of your ability. The third thing I want to say tonight is this is part two of a lesson that I started last night. So we don't have time to review all of that. We'll do a little bit, and then we must get to the points we want to make this evening. So if you were not able to be here last night, it's available, and you can go listen to it and catch up with the things you missed. We're asking the question in this series, is it reasonable to believe in God in this scientific age? The answers to that question are quite different in our age. Many would say it is absolutely unreasonable because of the evidence that we've learned about from science. You don't need God anymore, many would say. My answer to that question, I will say again at the beginning this evening, is that there are more reasons than ever to believe that there is a designer who created. You see on the screen before you, what that passage argues is that you can see God who is invisible. You can see him as you examine things that are made. That is the famous and I believe always most powerful argument for the existence of God from the natural world. It's the argument from design. If something was made, it implies there was a maker. That's the argument made in Romans 1, verse 20. So what I say about that is this. This book, which I'm convinced is the Word of God and which says God evidence that there's intelligent life out there in the universe. I know that because when I was at Harvard in 1967-68, my professor who was involved in this particular exercise came into class one morning and put on the board a signal they had received the night before on the radio telescope. And he made the point to the class, it looks to us like this particular signal is so organized that it could not have been produced by natural causes. And his conclusion was, it's entirely possible, ladies and gentlemen, that for the first time in man's history, we've received a signal from some... because it's a play on the words that SETI uses. And the fact is, folks, if you examine a cell carefully enough, there are signatures everywhere that this was made by somebody. It was designed. And I showed you some of those last night. Every living cell is full of evidence of design. In fact, every living cell has a language in it that we've learned to decode and read. It's called DNA. And we did a little study of that last night. And you remember that we said the DNA is located in the nucleus. It has information in it. It's copied. It's migrated. And then it's translated. Here in the ribosome, so proteins are built from the information in the DNA. Do I have time to rehearse all that tonight? No, I don't. But it's powerful evidence that somebody made that, folks. That is a system which did not come about by natural causes. But the question tonight is this. What about junk DNA? So let me ask you, class, how many in this class have heard of the expression junk DNA? Anybody? Okay, good. I'm glad you've heard of it. What I taught you last night was mostly known in the 1950s and the 1960s. We knew most of what I taught you that long ago. Starting in the 1970s, we began to discover there's something about the DNA that we didn't realize before. That's what I want to talk to you about tonight. It's pausing on me again. There we go. It appears, class, that in the DNA, there's a good bit of information that doesn't connect up with making proteins. In fact, it appears that in all of this information in the DNA, this process I described to you last night only takes a relatively small part of that entire DNA molecule. When the Human Genome Project was produced in 2003, and they mapped the entire DNA molecule, that happened in your lifetime, folks. That's one of the greatest breakthroughs in the history of mankind. We found out there's a whole lot of the DNA molecule that isn't involved in making proteins. In fact, most say today that only about 5% of that entire DNA molecule is used to make proteins. So the question is, what about the other 95%? So I want to read you some statements. I have several reasons for doing this, which will become clear as we go along. These statements began to come out in the late 70s and the early 1980s, and they became more and more vociferous into the 90s and the early 2000s. After we fully mapped the human genome, it became even worse. Here's a statement from Ken Miller, professor of biology at Brown University, made in 1994. Listen closely. The human genome is littered with pseudogenes, gene fragments, orphan genes, junk DNA, and so many repeated copies of pointless DNA sequences that it cannot be attributed to anything that resembles intelligent design. I'm letting that sink in a little bit. A little bit later, our favorite author, Richard Dawkins, said it this way. In his book, The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution, it is a remarkable fact, Dawkins wrote, that the greater part, 95% in the case of humans, of the genome might as well not be there for all the difference that it makes. In particular, pseudogenes are genes that once did something useful but now have been sidelined and are never transcribed or translated. What pseudogenes are useful for is embarrassing creationists. It stretches even their creative ingenuity to make up a convincing reason why an intelligent designer should have created a pseudogene unless he was deliberately trying to fool us. One more quote. The genome resembles nothing so much as a hodgepodge of borrowed, copied, mutated, and discarded sequences and commands that have been cobbled together by millions of years of trial and error against the relentless survival of the test of survival. It works, and it works brilliantly, not because it was designed, but because of the great blind power of natural selection to innovate, test, and discard, and fail in favor of what succeeds. What these gentlemen are saying is that what we've learned about DNA is it full of junk? And why would God, a grand designer, create something that's full of junk? I was first introduced to this when I was giving a speech on the campus of the University of South Florida on the subject of why we should believe in an intelligent designer. And I gave this speech I gave you last night. And a professor stood up during the question and answer session. He said, "Now, Dr. Payne, you've done a good job of explaining the amazing process of making proteins in our bodies. What you didn't tell this class is that that only takes about 5% of the DNA. And the other 95% we have discovered is mostly junk. Why didn't you tell him that? And how does that testify of your God? And I have to tell you, I was not prepared. It's hard to keep up with everything that's going on when you've got a full-time job. But I did say this to my defense. I said, well, sir, I don't have a good response ready for you tonight except to say this. I think I would be a little careful what I called junk. Because there's a bunch of leftovers that are just junk. You know, class, how many of those 150 that Biedersheim listed are now considered vestigial, useless pieces of junk? Depends on who you talk to, but mostly zero. Because we've learned what they do. But here's the point I want to make to you tonight. There has never been a time, nor will there ever be a time, when you will have the answers to any question somebody could throw at you that might question your faith or your belief in God. There will always be questions that can throw you into the realm of doubt because you don't know the answer. So the first thing I would tell you is be humble about that and recognize you're not going to know everything. The second thing I would tell you is God always and in every generation has supplied us with sufficient evidence that it's reasonable to believe in his existence. That's what Romans 1 teaches. And the same is true today. But I will tell you, if DNA is 95% junk, I got a problem with that as a creationist. Because I don't believe God would make something 95% junk, do you? So what do you do about that? Well, I'm happy to tell you, I want to tell you a little story tonight and give you a little piece of information that can lead you to start your own investigation. But I want to remind you one more time before we go on. When I get finished, I will not have answered every question that somebody can ask and cast doubt upon your faith. But I will tell you this, Hebrews the 11th chapter and verse 6 says, without faith it is impossible to please God. He who comes to God must believe that he is and that he is a reward. Well, I have a little book here I want to recommend to you. And by the way, I'm going to leave you, Bruce, by bibliography of all the books I referenced plus a whole bunch more. And I put stars by the best ones. So you can pursue this further if you like. This little book by Jonathan Wells, who himself is a researcher, is called The Myth of Junk DNA, copyright 2011. And he quotes in here numerous studies, researchers, and lots of other information to show you that the junk DNA proposal talked about so much in the 90s and the early 2000s is very much losing steam in our time. Because what we're finding out is the things they thought were junk have functions. So, for example, many non-protein coding DNAs code for various RNAs, and many non-protein coding DNA sequences are conserved. Now, let me see if I have a picture here. Let's go back just a minute. This. There are sections of this DNA here that don't code for proteins. And what we thought for a long time is that those sections were just useless. They were leftovers from your evolutionary past. What we're learning now is that those sections in DNA don't code necessarily for mature messenger RNA or ribosomal RNA or transfer RNA. They code for about 1,000 other RNAs that we didn't know anything about 10 years ago. There is practically the entire DNA coding for something. Maybe not this, but they're coding for something. And we're learning day by day more what those other kinds of RNA do. RNAs that are coded in the rest of this DNA are playing significant roles in controlling whether, where, and to what extent the protein coding regions are transcribed. So what we're beginning to learn, folks, is that the rest of that DNA is controlling what happens in the production of proteins and deciding when, how fast, and why those things are happening. It's very much like a computer system, an operating system that controls what's happening in a computer. If you want to have a software that works in a computer, you've got to have a lot of things working with it in your operating system to make it work. And what we're beginning to learn is that's exactly the kind of thing happening in DNA. So the things that they thought were junk are in fact doing critically important things to help proteins be built. Now, do you remember last night I told you when the messenger RNA is produced, there are some areas in it that are called introns, these white areas. Those are snipped out, and the messenger RNA is matured before it migrates outside the nucleus. And those introns were thought for many years to be leftover junk that are just thrown away. Let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, what we've learned about those introns is they're doing a whole lot more than we ever dreamed. Introns are rich in splicing factor recognition sites. I'm going to explain that in just a minute. They encode a majority of the small RNAs, and RNAs from introns influence gene expression. So those little pieces they thought were snipped out and were useless, now we're finding they do all kinds of critical things. They help us produce RNAs. They help us cut that thing up. Let's go back and look at it again. This piece of RNA has to be spliced. If this were an English paper, we'd call it edited. It has to be spliced and reconnected. And the white pieces, the introns in here, are performing functions that we never knew anything about. They're making RNAs. They're allowing us to put that mature messenger RNA together in a different way. And so it's a splicing mechanism that's tied up in those introns. So there are, in connection with that slicing and splicing operation, spliceosomes and editosomes. Now let me see what you remember from last night. What do you think those are, class? Ooh, you're good. Yes, spliceosomes and editosomes are proteins which help cut that thing up along with the introns and put it back in a different order. Now, here's what's amazing about that. What they are learning is that there are codes within codes and dual and overlapping messages inside every section of that DNA. So I'm going to read you a section from this book. Just to encode another message about enemy troop strength and movements, supplies of ammunition, and an impending enemy attack. The soldier who received the message can read the encoded message inside because he possesses the key, a cipher that allows him to identify the additional information inside. So you have a letter inside of a letter. I think it required intelligence to produce that, don't you? And what we're learning, ladies and gentlemen, that is in the code of the DNA, there are messages inside of messages. And that the introns and the proteins that work with it to splice and edit those things are able to pull those messages out. So now we know, class, that from one section of DNA that we thought could produce one protein, you may could produce as many as 1,000 different proteins by snipping it and putting it back together in a different order, using the very things that people thought were junk. And we're just beginning to learn and understand a lot of these things about junk DNA. And what what about a pseudogene? You heard several references to that. I want to tell you one, and I want to make this as graphic as I can make it, so you'll understand the message that the evolutionists are giving when they attack you as a creationist. What is your body doing with pseudogenes in it? Pseudo means what? Fake or false? I'll give you one illustration. Some claim your body and its DNA makeup has as many as 1,000 pseudogenes trapped in it. They say they're all left over from mutations that have taken place inside your genes. And they don't do anything except sit there and be an evidence of evolution. One of those is the gene that's connected with making vitamin C. As a human, your body doesn't make vitamin C. Rabbits do make vitamin C in their genetic structure. You need to take vitamin C. That's one of those vitamins your body doesn't produce. But inside your DNA, the evolutionists claim there's a section in there where you have a gene that looks like it used to be able to make vitamin C, but it doesn't work anymore. So it's a pseudo-gene. And therefore, they would say, why would God do that? Leave in your DNA a leftover that doesn't work anymore. And they would say to you, there's a bunch of them. Folks, I'm doing this talk tonight because I want you to see that there are ways that your children who are going to go off to college and listen to the biology and philosophy and other kinds of professors will attack their faith. So how do you answer that? I can tell you, as an 18-year-old facing that kind of information, your faith can be strongly challenged as to whether there really is a God or not. And did he make this or didn't he? So let me give you a short answer. The main thing I'm trying to do tonight is to tell you, you're always going to have something that will question your faith, but you also need to know there's enough groundwork laid that you have much to be solidly building on. And the evidence is building and multiplying that junk DNA is not junk at all. So in the latter section of this book, The Myth of Junk DNA, he has an appendix just to talk about the supposed pseudogene for vitamin C. And he goes through every argument that's made about that, and he shows that in the first place, this is not necessarily a gene for vitamin C. And in the second place, it is doing things. And in the third place, the conclusions that have been drawn are not nearly based on sufficient evidence to draw the conclusions. So there's plenty of work being done on that particular case that say a pseudogene may not be pseudo at all. Some have produced functional proteins, some produce RNAs that suppress the expression of their corresponding functional genes, and some produce RNAs that increase the expression of their corresponding functional genes otherwise. So we're finding that supposed pseudogenes are doing a lot of things that we didn't know they were doing before. In addition to that, we're learning that there's more information stored in DNA than anybody could have ever dreamed of, even 5 years ago. Because there are words, sentences, and paragraphs that are called genes, gene folders, and superfolders that organize the information in the DNA so that more is stuffed in there than anybody ever dreamed of. How do you pull that information out and use it? Because it's so well organized, and proteins and other RNAs allow us to get to that information in ways that nobody even recognized 10 years ago. There are long sections of repetitive non-protein coding DNA called lines and signs and ERVs. And the argument is, why is this DNA full of stuff that doesn't look like it's doing anything? And what we're learning is, all of these have a purpose in the DNA that help it do what it's supposed to do. So, the more we learn about the supposed junk DNA, the more it appears that it is designed. And so what I'm asking you to think about is that every time we look deeper in what God has done, everywhere we look, from the macroscopic to the microscopic, things clearly look like they've been made. Or as Michael Behe would say, there's a loud, clear, piercing cry of design everywhere you look. Junk DNA, ladies and gentlemen, is becoming the latest myth of the evolutionary theory. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is my main theme for tonight, and that's my talk for this evening. We thank you for your careful attention, and we're ready now for our close of the service. So if our song leader would come. Before we sing, let me just say this word to you. The Lord God of heaven, who we believe created us, also loved us enough, according to the scriptures, that he sent his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. In the 14th chapter of John, Jesus said, if you believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. So if there's one here tonight who's ready to confess the name of Jesus because you've become a believer in God, you need to follow him into the waters of baptism, having expressed your faith that you believe he's the Son of God. We don't ever want to leave an assembly until we're ready to have someone do that. So won't you come while we stand and as we sing.